Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Media in America have changed dramatically in the last decade. They're bigger, and local programming is on the wane. The PBS program Now reported recently that six companies own the television stations watched by 75% of Americans, and one-third of U.S. radio stations are owned by out-of-town conglomerates. Meanwhile, the Federal Communications Commission is reviewing media ownership rules and could lift remaining limits on media consolidation. Our guest this afternoon is sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. He says big media are not in the public interest. Kleinenberg traveled across the country to report on the state of American media. His findings are in his new book, Fighting for Air: The Battle to Control America's Media. Kleinenberg says his aim in this book is to tell two big overarching stories. One is about what's at stake. He says American democracy, in his words, requires a rich and varied supply of news and information in the public sphere, where communities large and small debate policy options, determine where to invest public resources, and decide how to protect the vulnerable or defend themselves. The second big story, he says, is about citizens from the left and right who, Kleinenberg says, see that big media are, quote, crushing creative and independent voices, destroying the rich American tradition of local reporting, and clogging the informational arteries that make democracy work. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good anywhere in the continental U.S. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, is an associate professor of sociology at New York University. His first book, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, was published by the University of Chicago Press. The new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, is published by Metropolitan Books, an imprint of Henry Holt and Company. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Eric Kleinenberg, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to talk with you again. We talked a couple years back now about heat wave, didn't we?
That's right. That was the acute disaster story where 700 people died in just a few days in Chicago, 1995. Fighting for Air is a kind of disaster in slow motion story. It's the story of what happened to the nation's media over this last decade.
Yeah. Well, your first book about that deadly Chicago heat wave that killed so many people in the summer of 1995 in a period of a week. You know, Chicago is known for being a robust news town. How did the media do in that situation?
Well, there's actually a chapter in Heat Wave about what I consider to be the local media's real failure to cover the event seriously. I think they followed the lead of the city administration in that event. The mayor's office, many people remember, consistently tried to downplay the event. They said, let's not blow this out of proportion. You know, the weather gets extreme in Chicago. But that's why people like Chicago, because we go to extremes. And actually, the city council in Chicago refused to hold hearings about what had happened. And this is a couple days when 700 people died. And they were mostly poor, mostly isolated, mostly old. They did not have a lot of political clout, and that made it, I think, a little bit easier for everyone to ignore it. And basically, the media in Chicago followed that lead. And what I found when I reviewed all the coverage from that event, and even when I went back to the newsrooms in Chicago to interview people about what happened, is a widespread sense that that the journalists in the city had just failed on the job. And so one of the things that I was very concerned about is that this heat wave, which should, in my view, have become a signal event in recent American history, it brings up a lot of issues, for example, that became more relevant after Hurricane Katrina. It never registered as a national event as of any real significance, and we failed to learn the lessons from that story. And actually, when I was in Chicago interviewing journalists, that's the first time I learned that there was a bigger thing happening in the media, too. A number of people at the Chicago Tribune, for example, said, you realize that there's a big story happening in journalism today, and one reason it's so hard for us to cover local events adequately is because we're already losing staff members, we're already being asked to do so much more work, to do television reporting, newspaper reporting, web reporting, and we just don't have the resources. And they said, if you really want to understand public life in this country today, we'd like your next book to be a book about what's happened in our business, the media business. And so I took them up on it.
Yeah. How are reporters coping?
Well, it's a very tough time to be a professional journalist in the United States. We are living through a time where there are just extraordinary cutbacks in the budget for journalism. You read about it occasionally when you see a story about hundreds or in some cases even more newspaper reporters who lose their jobs during a cutback. Many people will know about the story of the Tribune Company, which actually is the only company in the United States to own local newspapers and broadcast television stations in New York, L.A., and Chicago. And they've made dramatic cutbacks in there at the L.A. Times and also at New York's Newsday. And there are many people in both of these cities on the coast are up in arms about that. So reporters, I found, are feeling tremendously insecure. On the one hand, they would like to fight for their jobs. On the other hand, when you have such instability in a labor market, people become very concerned about pushing too hard. And so another issue that came up for me in doing work on this book is that journalists themselves have a very hard time covering what's happening in the media industry. I could put it another way, the media industry does not cover itself, especially when it comes to dealing with its own business and political interests. And so I'm not a journalist. I'm a professor at a university. Mm-hmm. I have the security of tenure. And so it was a little easier for me to tell the story of what's happened to the media. And sadly, I think we've reached a state where we actually need outside independent voices to tell this story well.
Yeah. Media, reporting on media doesn't work so well because of there's a conflict of interest there, I guess.
Sure. I mean, a number of people know this famous line from Upton Sinclair, who said, it's very difficult for people to tell the truth about an industry when telling when getting their paycheck requires not knowing the truth. It's hard to expect any industry to cover itself well, and that points to an irony when we talk about journalism, because journalism is the watchdog industry in a way. It's the profession that emerged not because the most powerful corporations and government agencies in this country want to have an aggressive, independent media. It emerged from the public interest in having journalism play a good role, a healthy role in democracy. And it's taken a long time to build up journalism as a profession and media as an institution. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about today is that as we've changed the structure of the media business, and so many media companies have been acquired by mega corporations that are actually invested in all sorts of industries, they have no special commitment to or care for journalism or news coverage. We have seen a real loss in the commitment to putting resources into the kind of day-to-day journalism or the kind of investigative reporting that once made this country's media system so famous. And this is a really important point to make. Oftentimes people compare the national media systems of one country to another, and that's important to do. But one of the great contributions of American media is to do this distinctively local news and programming, whether in the newspaper business or the radio. When you go to an American city, or at least historically when you went to Philadelphia or Chicago or Seattle or San Francisco, you could hear the sounds of those cities on the radio. You could read the voice of those cities in the newspaper. And one of the big arguments I make in Fighting for Air is that as a result of this kind of concentrated ownership and also a kind of cultural homogenization that's born of it, increasingly if you go to a different city and turn on the radio, it sounds exactly like it does where you live.
Hmm. One of the stations that you write about in Fighting for Air is WBEZ in Chicago, an NPR affiliate. And BEZ, like WILL, has a commitment to local programming. And folks there at WBEZ told you their listeners treasure that localness, if there's such a word. So do listeners to commercial radio prize that as well? And if so, why can't a local independent station do very well in the marketplace, a commercial station?
Yeah, well, the answer to that requires taking a few steps back in history, but I'll begin by saying that the concentration of ownership and really the rise of these distant corporate owners has been a boon to public radio. In fact, what I document in the book is that public radio listenership has doubled in the last decade, precisely at the time when commercial radio stations have gone decidedly non-local. And that's a great thing in many respects, but there is one issue about it, which is that the quality of original programming and even the quantity of original programming at the nation's supply of public radio stations really depends on the affluence of the particular community where it's situated.
Mm-hmm.
And so in communities where there's a strong interest in public radio and a membership that really contributes, in the pledge drives, that you probably just had a pledge drive there. Many stations I've talked to have had pledge drives recently. When listeners contribute to their local public radio stations, then they can afford to do independent local programming like the show we're doing right now or like many news shows. And WBEZ in Chicago really benefits from not just having a great reputation as a station, but also having a very affluent and large listenership. And there are other markets throughout the country where the public radio stations are really struggling to get that same level of commitment, and without contributions, it's very difficult to do this programming. And so actually, NPR at the national level has done a lot of the stuff that the big commercial stations have done. They've relied on a couple of big brand programs, which you may like very much for their content, but aren't providing local information. So it needs to be said that there's variation across the field of NPR affiliates.
Yeah. Has there been some friction between NPR and its member stations over these issues?
Well, I think one issue that the member stations are dealing with is figuring out as listenership moves to other domains, whether it's satellite radio or internet radio, what's the value added of having a local station? Can you add something that's really distinctive and that listeners can't get from other sources? And there are kind of disputes between local stations and the national public radio organization over how much it's going to cost to run programming and how to do something that's original and creative. And I think the reason I profile WBEZ in the book is because I think they've done very creative and bold moves to make sure that they're really doing good original programming there. And they've become a model for many stations around the country in that respect. But it is a difficult system. Now, you also asked this important question, which is, what has happened to commercial radio stations if there's such a demand for the local? And this is the question that I think we need to have some historical perspective on, because, about 25 years ago, it was illegal for any company in this country to own more than one AM and one FM station in the same market. And under the Reagan administration, we began a push to essentially relax the ownership caps. So people call this deregulation. I always follow Bob McChesney, a University of Illinois professor, who says really it's re-regulation, because broadcasters depend on regulation. If they don't get regulation, then anyone can broadcast a signal over theirs, and so that no one wants real deregulation. But but loosening the ownership caps. And this happened gradually until 1996. And that year, the Democrats in the White House and the Republicans in Congress worked together to pass the Telecommunications Act, which raised the local radio ownership limit to 8 in the largest markets. And it eliminated the national ownership limit altogether. And an extraordinary feeding frenzy occurred. Essentially, in 2 years, 40% of the nation's broadcast radio companies commercially changed hands, and a couple of companies took over hundreds, and in the case of Clear Channel Communications, 1,200 stations in just a few years. Now, when radio was a mom-and-pop business with a lot of small players, I think a couple of big players, but no one could get too big because of the ownership caps, the programming was intensely local. People knew the name of the radio station that they operated in, the name of the cities that they operated in. When the system changed and we allowed by law companies to own hundreds of stations throughout the country, the corporations realized there was a business efficiency in getting rid of the local programmers, the local DJs, local talk show hosts who provided information about the places where they operated. And instead, they started using either syndicated programs or highly increased use of automated programs. They used very sophisticated digital technologies to do what they call voice tracking, basically, which means you could have one employee tape or record in a remote studio anywhere in the world with a network connection, a four-hour air shift in about 20 minutes or 30 minutes time. And the nature of the radio really changed. And basically, companies started faking local broadcasts because they realized that people wanted the sound of something local, but they weren't really investing in doing original radio programming. And it's really just been in the last few years that the radio business has started to realize maybe this was a mistake. Maybe we've actually chased people off the dial.
Hmm. How was it that the Telecommunication Act of 1996 became law?
It was a very interesting story. It's a kind of inside the Beltway political story. The Clinton and Gore administration had their eyes on the big prize of creating the information superhighway. Remember that term from the mid-1990s? They really wanted to create a program that would help provide subsidies for the nation's telephone companies to improve their infrastructure and get more Americans online and faster speed internet connections. Probably many people know that was actually turned out to be a very bad deal because the industry did not make the investments in fiber optics that we had hoped that they would with our billions of dollars of subsidies. But the White House was so intent on this that they had a hard time dealing with some of the other issues. And this was the first term of Newt Gingrich's contract with America, that time when the Republicans took over Congress and really pushed a fairly radical agenda. And a high item on their agenda had been getting rid of these media ownership caps. And one has to understand the context of this in terms of D.C. politics or federal politics more generally. And the media business is tremendously powerful as a political actor. I call them political entrepreneurs, media companies, in my book. And this is not simply an issue of supporting one candidate or another, although we know that some media companies support certain parties or certain candidates. Media companies and communications companies more generally make tremendous investments in lobbying in Washington, D.C. and in state houses, and also in political contributions. And political officials know that their careers in some way are staked on their capacity to work in an amicable way with media organizations. And that's true for your local radio station and local newspaper and local television station, who, after all, can decide how to cover you as a candidate and when to air your advertisements if you're getting the politically subsidized ad time. And they can also kind of push back at you in terms of with their editorial content. And so politicians in this country, really since the beginning of our broadcast ownership laws, have had a very hard time regulating this industry. Some people say that the industry has become, the agency, the Federal Communications Commission, has become captured by the industry it's supposed to regulate. This is a very difficult political issue to make democratic, and that's one of the themes that I try to address in this book. It's also one of the things I call for at the end, a more democratic and accountable policymaking process when it comes to setting our media laws.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, could further reduce the limits on ownership. What's the likelihood of that happening now?
It looks, in fact, like it's wide open. I would have said a year ago that it was almost certain to go through, that the FCC has got a 3-2 Republican majority. The president appoints FCC commissioners, and the current chairman is a guy named Kevin Martin, who was a member of the Bush-Cheney staff in the 2000 election and has worked with the president on a number of issues. He has signaled his support for loosening ownership caps on a number of issues. One issue that's very live right now, one proposal, involves getting rid of the cross-ownership ban, and that's a rule we've had on the books since 1975 that prevents one company from owning both a local newspaper and a broadcast television station in the same market, based on the theory that newspapers and television stations, local TV stations, are the most popular sources of local news, and so it would be unhealthy for democracy to have one company own both of them. Now, Martin has already signaled that he intends to get rid of that law. He would like it repealed. Essentially, if he does so, it will be legal for one company to own every newspaper in town, up to 3 television stations, 8 radio stations, the cable system, lots of websites. So I'm quite concerned about this, and my sense is that that's an issue that he is likely to try to, where he's likely to try to make a ruling. The National Association of Broadcasters recently filed a paper saying, a statement at the FCC saying they would like to see the local radio ownership limits raised to 10 or 12 stations in big markets. And here, the jury is really out. And basically, what's changed in the last several months is that the Democrats who've now taken over Congress have signaled that they're frustrated about the rise of this media consolidation and the attendant problems. They're saying that they're going to hold hearings in Congress in the next few months, and it should be said that the FCC is going around the country holding a series of 6 hearings on ownership. And essentially, every time there's a public hearing on this issue, you get a consensus, a really stunning consensus, in my view, from the right and the left, groups like the National Rifle Association and the Christian Coalition and the Parents Television Council on the right have joined with MoveOn.org and the ACLU and Common Cause and Free Press to do this kind of remarkable coalition, saying we are really fed up with the loss of local control. We're fed up with the loss of local content. In some cases, it's had disastrous outcomes. And we are demanding more of the kind of coverage that we need and really deserve. And so at the hearings, the FCC commissioners and congressional officials are learning, boy, this is a hot button issue that actually Americans cared very deeply about what's on our TV stations and our radio stations and on the front page of our newspaper. And maybe if they keep on conceding so much of a public resource, the airwaves, if they keep on conceding so much control to a handful of corporations that aren't really interested in the public interest, that the voters will lash back at them. So now it's become a bit of a hot button issue, and I think that if as many Americans this year speak out in the way that they have in recent years about this issue, the FCC might actually reverse course.
Well, so the commissioners are listening, kind of.
Well, they have gone around the country doing these hearings. They've done one in Los Angeles, one in Nashville. There's one coming up this Friday in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I sat in on a bunch of these hearings. I went to L.A., but I've gone in previous years as well. And it's just overwhelming. You find hundreds and hundreds of people who are willing to wait in line for hours for a chance to watch the hearing, to say something for the 2 minutes that they are allocated in the open comment period. It's very hard to find another issue where Americans are willing to do so much just for a chance to participate in the debate, but they're overwhelming. And so what's happened in the recent past is that the FCC has solicited public comments like this and then totally ignored them. So in 2003, for example, Michael Powell, Colin Powell's son, who was the FCC chairman at the time, he got the same kinds of feedback. I mean, millions of Americans were writing letters saying, enough of this consolidation. We really want more local, more accountable media. And Powell just ignored it altogether. And so, the circumstances were a little bit different then, because it was an all-Republican government, essentially, and they were acting with impunity, with, you know, very little concern for the democratic wish. And now I think that there's at least a mix of parties and a little bit of political competition in Washington, D.C. Leaders from both sides of the aisle are a little bit more cautious and a little bit more responsive.
Eric Kleinenberg is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's an associate professor of sociology at New York University and the author most recently of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned a moment ago that there have been some disastrous outcomes thanks to these rules. And you begin Fighting for Air with a very dramatic story, the story of a toxic chemical spill in Minot, South Dakota in 2002. Give us some sense of that story and what happened there in that community.
Minot's in North Dakota.
I'm sorry.
But
I was thinking of Grizzly Gulch, I think.
Well, there's Grizzly Gulch, too, which is another story that I tell in the book. I mean, and I should just say that, you know, there's a lot of disaster stories in the book for two reasons, I think. One of them is that, you know, we live at a time when we are tremendously concerned about the securing the homeland and dealing with the threat of disasters, both natural, the Katrinas of the world, and also unnatural, the kind of September 11th. And we're making tremendous investments politically in resources to strengthen our homeland. And I am very concerned that consolidation has led to a real communications breakdowns during the time when we most need good contact. And so I profile a number of stories from the Syracuse, New York, where in August of 2003, in that incredible blackout that swept across the Northeast and took the power out of 50 million homes, the dean of the communications school, a guy named David Rubin, he was in his office. He went down to his car to get a radio broadcast when the power went out, and we always go to radio when the power goes out because it's our best resource for that. And he tuned into his all-news station and started getting news reporting on what was happening in the streets of Manhattan, because the radio company in Syracuse that owned the all-news station, it happened to be Clear Channel Communications, they had gotten rid of so many local reporters that they couldn't actually cover what was happening where he lived, and he was irate about this. So that's one big reason to tell those stories. And another big reason to tell them is that they're very dramatic, and they humanize and illustrate the significance of this issue of media consolidation, which frankly is usually discussed in very dry and abstract terms, and it can be very difficult to connect the story of, you know, GE buying NBC or Disney buying ABC. It can be difficult to connect that story of that to our lives. And so in Minot 5 years ago, a train derailed early in the morning. It was carrying anhydrous ammonia, a highly toxic chemical, and it spilled 240,000 gallons of it that quickly formed a poisonous cloud. It grew to be 5 miles long and 2.5 miles wide, and it floated over town, seeped into the homes of 15,000 people there. They got really anxious because if you start breathing in anhydrous, it burns your respiratory system, it burns your eyes, burns your skin. If you breathe in enough of it, it will kill you. And people started turning to their radio station to find out what had happened and what they could do to stay safe. And just for context's sake, you remember, this is just a few months after September 11th, and the nation was really anxious. And so I think people were worried, and I know people were worried that they were under attack of some kind. And I know that, by the way, because I actually tracked down the transcripts, but also the audio files of every single call to 911 that night, and I used those to tell the story. And basically what happened is people tuned in their radio, and to get emergency information, they went to their designated emergency broadcaster, and instead of getting information about how to stay safe, they were getting the same canned programming that plays every night in Minot, the same smooth-talking DJs, the same big country, the same classic rock and easy-listening music, and it was profoundly estranging for people. I mean, I would just ask you to imagine that there's a major disaster where you live, that, you know, in the Champaign-Urbana area, there's a toxic spill, and you're trying to find a way to stay safe. And when you turn on the radio, you know, you get Britney Spears. It's just horrific. And so people started calling 911 and asking, you know, where can I go for help? And the operators didn't realize this was malfunctioning. There was this malfunctioning on the radio system, and they kept referring people back. So people got more and more frustrated. And what had gone wrong was that the local officials had tried to operate the emergency alert system, which is the new system that should have allowed them to automatically override the broadcast from the emergency radio station, but the technology didn't work. And so they then did the next best thing, which is they picked up the phone and they called the station, and no one answered the phone. And they realized that this was a real crisis because the station, KCJB, was owned by Clear Channel Communications, and so were all six of the non-religious commercial stations in Minot. All six were owned by Clear Channel, and they operated out of two centralized offices. This is literally kind of consolidated operations. And not only were they running on autoplay, you know, piping in content that had been pre-programmed in a remote studio with that voice tracking technology I talked about before, mm-hmm. but they also had gotten rid of the local office staff, so there was no one there to answer the phone. And literally, the people in town could not get through to anyone at the radio stations. They tried and tried and tried. It didn't happen. And the result is that people spent hours that morning without the kind of emergency information that would have allowed them to avoid harm.
And it was a broadcaster eventually from the religious station in town who said, I'm going in and we're going to, get this on the air.
Yeah, and someone from Clear Channel, a guy who'd been at the station for decades, from before it was a Clear Channel station, wound up driving into the office, too. I mean, this is, the story here, the people who work in radio are really upset about this, probably more than anyone because they know how many jobs have been lost and they've seen their colleagues lose their work, and they're worried about losing their work, too. This guy was very committed to doing public service programming. He was just the one news reporter for all six of the Clear Channel stations, and he wasn't working then. So he drove in. He actually was injured in the course of driving, and he still has problems from it. And he did what he could a couple hours late. But I recently, after the book came out, I got a call from a radio reporter in Fargo, North Dakota, and he told me that actually his station had to pick up the news coverage in Minot for the Minot stations because Clear Channel had so few investments in local personnel in Minot that they couldn't cover the stories, just like the Syracuse thing. So people in Minot were actually getting news about Minot from reporters based in Fargo who were working the phones to find out what had gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And this is a story, this is not just a Minot, North Dakota story. This is a story that you can hear in city after city across the country. It's not always an acute disaster that triggers kind of public awareness of it. Sometimes it's just the cultural programming. You notice that the DJ who says he's working in your hometown is actually mispronouncing the names of places he should know. He's fictionalizing experiences he hasn't had, and that's a practice that Clear Channel and other big radio stations started to use, basically faking local broadcasts. And I observe this in the television industry, too. The book tells the story of the Sinclair Broadcast Group, which is the company that owns more television affiliates than any other corporation in the United States. They became infamous in the run-up to the 2004 election because this is the company that said they were going to air the Stolen Honor documentary about John Kerry, this kind of Swift Boat documentary right before the election. And they also refused to allow their ABC affiliates to air the Nightline episode where Ted Koppel read the names of all the American war casualties in Iraq. So they were politically on the map, but in the television industry, they became famous for doing this central cast local television news broadcast every night where they would force their stations to play these newscasts that looked like they were being done locally in-house, but in fact used a lot of material from a central studio in Baltimore where meteorologists, for example, would do reports for five different cities in a single afternoon.
Yeah, that strikes me as really wild. You know that your local forecaster is not in where you are, but in a big city far, far away.
Yeah, and you would say that the least that they could do if they were going to operate like that is tell viewers, look, we're using this new system that takes advantage of cutting edge technology to try to centralize the operation, but instead they were just deceiving viewers. So you would have no idea of knowing that you're a meteorologist who would say things like, we see a snow system coming our way, and we have big winds here tonight. They would see them, and they wouldn't realize that they were actually, piping it in from a suburban studio of Baltimore. And I actually think I'm the only person to have gotten inside of the Sinclair Broadcast Group television studio. I spent a day there profiling.
How did you get in there?
Well, I tried to get in, and they you know didn't want me to do it. And finally, Rolling Stone magazine asked me to do a profile of Sinclair, and I think they were so eager for attention, they had fantasies about you know the cover of Rolling Stone, that they let me in. So I got to spend a full day there. And I can say it was quite a day. It was, they had this kind of space age facility that was really designed to be the future of television news. But it was creepy, you know, the vice president, a guy named Mark Hyman, who also did a nightly editorial called The Point, which was this kind of extreme right-wing rant that all the stations, again, in their news fleet had to carry. Someone called them his editorials like, they made Bill O'Reilly sound like Walter Cronkite. He showed me around for the day, and he would brag about, you know, the robotically controlled cameras that allowed them to save money since they didn't have to hire human beings. And he took me on this, you know, personalized tour where I spent maybe 10 hours with him that day, but we spent some time in the meteorology studios, and I would watch this guy, show me how they did the nightly forecast for four or five cities. He brought me to the library that adjoined the studios where you could see the pronunciation guides for all the different towns and neighborhoods and the atlases. And I thought, if this is the future of broadcast news, this is really creepy. I can't think that this is a good thing for Americans. And that's another thing I really think I need to emphasize here, which is that what makes the story of the media business so different from the story of Walmart and retail or Starbucks in the coffee world is that these are businesses that depend on use of the public airwaves. And the deal in this country has always been that in exchange for getting licenses to use this public resource, the airwaves, corporations would do public service, public programming that worked for communities, that gave us the news and information and cultural materials that we needed for democracy or to make life interesting. And I believe that in allowing companies like Clear Channel and Sinclair to get so much control of our local media system and to use that system to fake local broadcasts to deceive viewers, that we have allowed a great institution in this country, our local media system, to be diminished, and I think we're paying a price for that today.
Hmm. Yesterday, the 19th of February, 2007, Sirius and XM said they'd like to merge, and that's pending regulatory approval by the FCC. What are your questions, what are your thoughts about such a merger, and what are media activists saying about this? I know it's only been 24 hours.
Yeah, I haven't really heard from the media activists about their thoughts. I mean, generally, I think probably most people, whether you're a media activist or you're a libertarian like William Safire, you're concerned about competition, whether there's competition in an industry. I mean, William Safire I mentioned because he became one of the great spokespersons for the case against media consolidation when he wrote this series of op-eds in the New York Times saying, big is not better when it comes to media, and he's concerned about the lack of competition. So monopolies aren't good for capitalism. They mean there's no real incentive to compete, and it means that consumers' interests can oftentimes be forsaken. So now here's an interesting case of satellite radio, because these are two companies, XM and Sirius, that invested really massively in infrastructure to try to do something that would compete with broadcast, free broadcast radio. And I think the reason that more than 12 million Americans subscribed to pay and are willing to pay for their service is because they're so frustrated with what the broadcast radio companies are providing. They were explicitly told that they had to compete. The FCC would not allow them to merge just about 10 years ago. But they've invested so much, and they have not been able to attract enough subscribers to compensate for that. And so they're operating with annual deficits, even though, their revenues are hundreds of millions of dollars, I think $600 million for one and about $900 million for the other, but they still have net losses every year. And so clearly what's going on is that these guys are trying to do this merger before before the Democrats really make a formal commitment to ending this media consolidation business. And the FCC is still leaning 3-2 Republican and will be, at least, unless the Democrats win the White House a couple years from now. So they're trying to make sure they get this merger in while the political conditions are still favorable to them. But I think it's going to be an uphill battle, because they have to persuade the FCC to do this thing, which the FCC has said in the past it didn't want to do. And moreover, if the FCC does approve it, then the question becomes, what are the conditions that it's going to impose to allow it to go through? So, for example, will these companies have to, or this merge company, will it have to provide some set of stations that do independent programming, you know, non-commercial programming? Will they have to have some kind of policy that guarantees that independent organizations are going to have access to the system and will be able to do their own broadcasts? Will they, for example, have to provide some kind of subsidy to allow low-income people a chance to get reduced-rate subscriptions? All these kinds of things are up in the air. You know, what's going to happen if you're a regular consumer? You know, will they jack up their monthly rates because, you know, there's no alternative on satellite? There's another question, which is that the free broadcast radio stations have pushed very hard to make sure that satellite companies cannot do local broadcasts, cannot provide local content, which in my view is kind of absurd given how badly the commercial radio stations have done in terms of providing their own local content. But they're asking the satellite companies to compete on an uneven playing field because you know, they can only do national programming. And so it would be interesting to see that debate get taken up. So I am, you know, I'm concerned about this proposed merger, but I also think what it reflects is this trend in our society right now and in our politics right now, and that is when there's trouble in an industry, and when it comes to media, immediately the fix that everyone suggests is consolidation. And I think it's time for some more imaginative ideas about how we might get a better media system. I think we have now, after 10-plus years of consistent consolidation, deregulation, loosening the ownership caps, we have a very clear record that consolidated mega media companies are not serving the public very well. So why would we think that the XM-Sirius merger would come out any differently?
We're running down on time. I've got a listener who would like to talk with you. So let's go and talk with this listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. For the author who is your guest today, you're preaching to the choir. I don't know if you know that. Bob McChesney has a media criticism show on this station once a week.
Uh-huh.
And also we have in our area one of these Sinclair stations.
Uh-huh.
And we have heard Mark Hyman.
Oh, yeah.
Luckily, he switched network affiliation, so I don't have to hear him anymore right before the late-night comics come on.
Uh-huh.
But what I'm wondering is, I want to step back to Michael Powell.
Yep.
Did he ever give a reason why he wasn't listening to the feedback from all the people who opposed FCC policies?
He did, actually, and it's a really important question, and I tell the story at length in Fighting for Air. And basically, what Powell said is, you know, the Democratic expression was, what he was hearing from people, that reflected a kind of 19th century sensibility. You know, he said, why listen to people on a bells and whistle tour when you go to these public open hearings, when the real way to make policy decisions in the 21st century is to use real hard science? And he claimed that the hard scientific research that the FCC had done with its media bureau, which has a lot of economists and that outsources a lot of studies, that they had essentially proven that there's lots of competition in media markets, that we don't need to be concerned about these traditional ownership issues, you know, that I'm so concerned about. And so, you know, 10 years ago, it would have been very easy for an FCC commissioner to make this claim and to intimidate everybody else around, because once you start introducing this technical research, it turns the debate into a rarefied one rather than to an open one. But something different is going on today, and basically there are all these activists and scholars and lawyers and critics who are trained to look closely at the research and find out if it's good. So let's now consider some of this FCC science that legitimated Powell's decision.
I can't give you a whole lot of time.
Okay, so that's what
that's what the
courts did, and what they found, for example, is that Michael Powell's FCC science said that in New York City, the Dutchess Community College public access television station was more influential and important than the New York Times, which was ludicrous on its face. We also learned that the FCC literally suppressed ownership studies that showed the opposite of what it wanted to find. And so the courts actually rejected Powell's deregulatory order, and now these issues are up for grabs.
Yeah. Let me mention that Bob McChesney's show, Media Matters, airs Sunday afternoons at 1 p.m. Central Time here on AM 580. One last thing before we have to wrap up, and just a quick thought on this battle over the Internet with telephone and cable over possibly slowing down or charging extra for access to the Internet. What do you think is going to happen there?
I'm happy you mentioned that. This is the issue people talk about, is net neutrality or equal access online. Basically, the telephone and cable industries want to be able to change the way the Internet works so that if you're a big corporation, you pay them a lot of money, your site will come to us in our homes much faster than everyone else's. It creates a two-tier, at least, system. In my view, this will stifle innovation and competition and openness on the Internet. I think there's zero public interest benefits that come from this, but there's billions to be made for the telephone and cable companies. When it got proposed, it looked like it was going to go right through and the industry would get its wishes. But 1.5 million Americans joined the SaveTheInternet.com coalition. You should know about this. It's the SaveTheInternet.com coalition. And they pushed even the Republican Congress to change its votes, and the thing stalled in committee. This is a very live issue. I mean, everyone needs to know this today, because in the near future, we will get massive amounts of our media, including our telephone service, our television service, movies, music, through the Internet. And so the way we regulate broadband is going to be tremendously consequential. I'd urge you to go to the SaveTheInternet.com coalition website and check out this issue today.
Eric Kleinenberg, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
It's great to be back here.
Eric Kleinenberg is the author most recently of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. The book is published by Metropolitan Books, an imprint of Henry Holt and Company. It's 1:52 Central Time. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago on the boards of trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Kansas City Board of Trade, the nearby March contract of $44.93 settlement price there. They were down 2.5 cents. The May were off 5.25 at 5.02.5. From Chicago Board of Trade, futures narrowly mixed in the corn. The beans were up about 4 to 7 cents for the afternoon. March wheat there, soft red, down 3.5 in the nearby contract, 4.64.5 the settlement price. The high at 69.5, the low at 62.75. March wheat settled at 4.64.5. They were off 3.5 cents today in Chicago. May contract for the soft red, 4.83 the high. Low at 76, settlement price 2 above that at $4.78. They were down 3 cents in July, which is the harvest month. $4.92 and a quarter the high, the low at 85 and a quarter, settlement price at 4.87 and a quarter. They were down 4 and a quarter for the day. September futures now $4.99 the high, the low at 93, settlement price at 93.5, down a nickel. And December contract down 8.5 cents at 5.02 and a half, with a high at 10 and 3 quarter cents, the low at $5.02. That for the December wheat futures. Corn pit now, March contract $4.20 the high, low at 4.14, settlement price at 4.15 and a quarter, down a penny and 3 quarters. May contract 4.32 and a half the high, the low at 26.5, settlement price at 4.28 and a quarter. They were down a penny and a quarter. July futures 4.41 and a half the high, the low at 30.